Welcome back to the Hacking Neurodivergence Podcast, the podcast all about people living their lives and hacking their neurodivergence in order to live it. I'm your host, Kelsey Terry, and today is no exception. We connect with my former colleague, Bisola. She's a digital product designer located in Arizona. And so without further ado, here's my conversation with Bisola. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Today, we'll discuss your upbringing, navigating predominantly white work environments as a person of color. And then we're going to talk about the diagnosis gap that exists and your self-advocacy when medical providers say there's nothing to be done. We're going to wrap up with a lightning round of questions. How does that sound to you?
Sounds good.
Perfect. Okay. Let's set the stage. I would love to hear, what was your adolescence like? Take me back to, let's go elementary school.
Yeah, elementary school was interesting. So I actually skipped kindergarten. I did half a year in kindergarten, half a year in first grade, and I didn't really understand why. But I guess I was just super advanced that they were just like, let's just send this five-year-old into first grade. And I pretty much excelled ever since. I think elementary school was very interesting for me because I was just painfully shy. And I think it is also because I had crazy anxiety and my coping mechanism was just to smile. So everybody was like, oh, you're so cute. You just smile until you just want to crawl away and hide and read some books. But I'd say elementary school was pretty fun once I kind of got over the hurdle of being the youngest in the grade and not really feeling like I belong there because everybody is older. And then when it got towards, I'd say like middle school, high school, that's when I kind of kicked it into high gear, being in like IB, International Baccalaureate classes, AP classes, doing crazy different types of extracurricular activities. In P Club, National Honor Society, and I think the added fact that my parents, being such African parents, really honed in on the fact that education is the top priority. So I overachieved as much as possible, and yeah, that shows later in life on how I experience and process things when I'm not perceived as an overachiever.
Tell me a little bit more about when you're not perceived as an overachiever or how that comes out.
I guess it feeds a little bit into the thought of imposter syndrome. So with one of the elements of being, I guess, like a natural genius or like a superhero complex where I'm immediately supposed to know this, I should take everything on myself and organize it in a way that only my brain can do this and I need to excel, overachieve. And then when I'm not hitting those markers, at least in my mind, I feel like I'm failing. And so I'm just like, I don't know what to do. And so that's where those gaps tend to happen.
So let's go back to when that was happening. Was it you pushing yourself into those AP classes or was it your parents like insisting like, this is the standard and you must rise to beat it? Tell me about that distinction, if it existed at all.
I think it was a combination of both. It was my parents very early on letting us know that education is number one and we should not pay attention to anything else that takes our attention away from education. And on the flip side, my self-motivation, knowing how much that meant to my parents and knowing that all my friends were in all of these honors and AP courses, like I wanted to stay with my friends too. So it was just a bit of balancing both what I saw from my parents, what they wanted from us, and then additionally being with my friends. But I think there's also an added aspect of society saying that, oh, because you are in like the top 5%, you can go to this wonderful college. And then from there, all these doors will open. So it's like that added societal pressure that forces that mindset of like, oh, I really need to be in all these classes, do all these extracurricular activities, just have this impressive resume, and then I'll be successful in society. So it was like a lot of added things that pretty much just piled on top of each other.
So you're, let's say, 16, 17 years old, and you're feeling that pressure, doing all these superstar classes. How did you manage that pressure at that age?
I honestly don't know. I think a little bit helped by being in music classes that had nothing to do with, I guess, just like general academics of being in AP and IB courses. I gravitated to music and web design engineering courses that just made sense. There was nothing that really, I guess, was a trigger for me to be in those things. I just gravitated towards it. So with music, I played the violin for about 7 years at that time. So much to the point where I ended up being concert mistress my senior year. And it was one of those things. Thank you. It was one of those things that I really took pride in and wanted to, I guess, just take music for myself. And it allowed me to be super creative. And then when it came to my keyboarding class, I wonder if they still have those, but keyboarding classes and web design classes, I excelled in those spaces because it was just like, it makes so much sense to me. HTML makes so much sense. And it got to the point where I finished one of my web design classes 2 months early, that I would just check in with the teacher and then leave to go to the band room and then practice. So
wow.
I was able to double dip with both of those interests. And that, I think that really kept me sane because I felt so much pressure in keeping up with my grades and keeping up with all the things that I had subjected myself to just to have this impressive resume.
So there's a societal pressure, right? I mean, to have great grades, get into a great school, and on you go. Did you hold the perspective that you could let off your foot off the gas when you got to college? Or were you just thinking, like, maybe this is just who I am? I do everything with excellence, and, like, therefore, this pressure will always be there. Did you think, like, there was an end in sight when you were maybe a senior in high school?
No. It's kind of sad to think about it. When I got my acceptance to Howard and I managed to get a full ride scholarship to go there as well. And with those two things in mind, I told myself before I started my freshman year, all I'm going to do is go to classes and go to my room and study. And that was it. So with that mentality going into college, it was more so like I need to continue this excellence. I cannot let my grades slip. I cannot do anything to compromise this scholarship or else I would not be able to go to college in general. And so that added a little bit more pressure. It was intense. It was very intense.
So did music follow you into college? So like in high school, you said that was a stress relief and it was like play and joy. It brought you all this goodness. Did that exist in Howard, or did you have to find a new coping mechanism to balance the stress?
I had to find a new one. I did initially think about what my major would be. The biggest stipulation for my scholarship was that I was a woman of color majoring in computer science. So
okay. That
was already a given. And it was computer science is one of the three options that I had in my mind. The first was to major in violin or just some sort of classical music. Linguistics, because I love to learn languages and I love to like learn about words and things like that. And then the last one was computer science. And so computer science, getting the scholarship, going to Howard, it was just one of those things that I felt was chosen for me, even though I already had interest in that area, but it wasn't as strong as having like the creative freedom that being in music would have given me.
I'll say, knowing your story and like what you do for a living now, going back to your whipping through website design, did you skew more towards like the styling of that website? Yeah. Spoiler alert, you become a designer. But I'm curious which way you skewed in high school. Were you more like, oh, let's architect like a really performant website? Or were you more like, let's make something beautiful and like intuitive to use?
It was the latter. I think in the times of MySpace, Xanga, I would work with my friends and we would make Xanga templates and would design it and add color and things like that with HTML and CSS. And then once everybody moved over to MySpace, the same thing followed. So I already had the mindset of, oh, what should this look like? How do I want people to experience this website? How do I want people to see this with the hierarchy? Having that in my mind early on without knowing what the term was or just the field, I felt very lost, which is why I leaned towards going to web design courses, like classes with Adobe Dreamweaver, things like that, because I felt like that could get me closer to it without really finding like an art class or doing graphic design, because it didn't really fit in what I wanted to do.
That was very interesting.
Before we go into the chapter of your time at Howard University, I want to go back. I mean, you are living a career of academic excellence. How else might your neurodivergence have appeared during your, let's say, high school, middle school era?
I would say mostly in terms of my anxiety and what I leaned towards, or like what I excelled in. I excelled mostly in, I guess, like traditional STEM environment. So math made sense to me. Sciences made sense. Engineering courses, computer courses, like all those things made sense to me. But when it came to, I had the one course with IB, Theory of Knowledge. Love the teacher, hated the course because it was like, how do you know what you know that you think you know? It was just like a lot of philosophical stuff, and my brain just could not handle it. And the fact that I had, I managed to slip by with like a B or a C, I think he felt so bad for me because I just could not deal. I think it presented itself in the classes that I was able to excel at, but then ultimately, I end up being in that as my career. So it worked out in the end. But in high school, it was just like, I need to balance all these things. I can't get a C in this class if I want to keep my grades up or be in the top 10%.
Okay, so we're going to fast forward to Howard. You earn a full ride scholarship with a great academics, and you're a woman in STEM, pursuing STEM. What was your college experience like? You're out of the house, but you're within the region of where you grew up. Talk to me about your college experience.
Yeah. So Howard is roughly 45 minutes to an hour outside where I grew up in Maryland. So I wasn't far by any means. And it was actually the closest college that I had applied to as well. And I think the added fact that one of my older sisters, she is an alumna from Howard as well. So I already somewhat experienced Howard and knew about the legacy and knew about just the cultural importance over the years. But being able to experience it myself was very different. And like I mentioned earlier, coming into the mindset of, oh, I need to go to class and go to my room, and that's it. Starting with that as a freshman, I realized how isolating that was. And I think that was the first time I truly understood and experienced depression. And with that, I realized I should socialize more. I should find friends. And that's where I was able to slowly find a community with people inside my major, people who also loved similar subjects that I did. I found friends who loved Korean dramas and loved K-pop. And so we were able to build a community there. And I think being able to be at Howard also brought another part of my identity up front. Growing up as an African American, but like the most literal sense, being Nigerian and Sierra Leonean, and then also being in a predominantly Black space too, made me understand a little bit more about Black culture, because that wasn't something, I guess, explicitly shown to me and experienced growing up. And so I was able to learn a lot about just like Black struggles, about how just African-American history, since it's one requirement getting a degree at Howard, is everyone has to take an African-American studies course, like no matter what. And so it was very interesting to take a course in the African diaspora, which my parents are somewhat part of that too, but it kind of like brought the whole full circle around just understanding just general culture. And I think the added fact of being able to embrace myself and experience who am I as a person outside of my academic struggles, like what do I like, these are my friends, what other types of identities that are out there that I could figure and explore about myself. I think that was also something that was important that came out of my experience at Howard, because I was able to really start to deep dive into who I am as a person and what are some things that I like, because I didn't really have the space or the capacity to really deep dive into that.
When you think about that, the idea of kind of building who you become, and you have the opportunity to question, what do I like? What do I care about? What advice might you give to someone who wants to go through that process, or maybe they're in that process right now? What would you say to your younger self?
Ooh, I would say try to be as open as possible, even if it's something that you don't think you might like. You might have a preconceived notion about something, but then being able to safely experience it, or being able to experience it with someone that you trust, could possibly bring more value to your life. And I would say also try to open every door that you can, because you never know what you're going to find. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's great wisdom. I didn't experience that until I left my home of 30 some years in Minnesota. And it really caused me to interrogate my own beliefs of like, do I actually like X? Mm-hmm. Do I want to do Y? and just dismantling kind of like what I thought were some of those preconceived notions. So glad to hear that you were doing that in college, in that safe environment where you were checking out different doors to see like, what do I actually care about in this, you know, post badass high school or high school experience that you had? Okay. So let's see. I'm just taking a look at my notes. So you are pursuing a degree in engineering, and right, that's a contingency of that scholarship that you had earned. Were you enjoying it, or like, what was your engagement level with the engineering discipline, let's say midway through your college years?
I would say my second and third years of college were the hardest. It was a combination of the courses that were required of those years. It was more of back-end related, like machine, like old time machine, like COBOL, just like nitty gritty back-end stuff that I did not care about. And I remember it was also one of my worst depression bouts as well, where I just basically began to disassociate within my classes. And I remember sitting in my computer organization class and just typing fan fiction, which is just the randomest thing. But I felt like I needed to go to my happy space, or just like a space that I felt more comfortable in this uncomfortable world and space, being in computer science, still not knowing if this is a right field for me, even though I love computers, I love web design, I love interacting and creating experiences for users. The courses that I had taken at that point, I wasn't sure if it really aligned to what I wanted to do. So my sophomore and my junior year were just like the grossest courses that I had to take in. And I think the great thing about those 2 years was when I really started to tap into the community in my major. I began to really reach out to my classmates, develop friendships where we were able to create a lot of just like study groups. And after class, we would go into the computer lab and work on projects together and things like that. And that's how I started to create lifelong friends. Some of the friends that I went to college with are my friends today. And so it was really nice to get out of my shell a little bit and like go past my crippling anxiety and just ask for help, because that was also something that was frowned upon a little bit, but then also plays on that imposter syndrome, like natural genius / I need to do everything myself mentality that I was basically forced to take on growing up as well. And so now that I'm able to dismantle that thought process and those feelings, I can reach out to friends, I can reach out to teachers and basically ask, like, I don't know what's going on in this class. If I need help, please help me. And even though I passed the class with a D and the D allowed me to still keep my scholarship and graduate, I do think that despite struggling through those 2 years, I think those 2 years were the time of massive growth for me.
Next, we're going to shift into your career in tech. And so you are graduating school. Talk to me about your very first job in the tech space. Were you an engineer? Were you a designer? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I got a job as a software engineer a couple months after I graduated, and that role made me move to Arizona, where I am today. And through the first 2 months, they take you through Java development training. Mentally speaking, I was just like, oh my goodness, I have a job. I'm a software engineer. But then on the flip side, I'm like, I don't really like this. I don't really identify with this. This is more back end versus the front end, designing experiences, things like that. So I would say 5-6 months in, I decided to leave and switch to another role. And that other role, I ended up being a web developer, a contract web developer. And through there, I was more front-end developer, which has got me a little bit more closer to what I wanted to be. And I remember asking that team, when can I work on design? Or how can I learn more about the design? And they're like, oh yeah, the design team's like somewhere over there. We don't really talk to them. And that kind of made me sad, because I wasn't able to learn more learn more in the area that I wanted to grow. But it did feel nice to get more industry knowledge and experience being a web developer. And then it wasn't until I transitioned into a consultant. And from there, I really was given the opportunity to grow as a UX professional, learn the foundations about UX, learn more about how to ask the right questions, how to break down complex problems and form it in a way that we can identify the right solutions and then create some sort of design and implementation. And so through my consulting journey, I moved from a web developer to a design technologist, someone who straddles both design and engineering, to a UX designer and then a product designer. So I kind of was like slowly moved over to the creative dark side over time, because it just aligned a lot more to what I wanted to do and being able to advocate for users and learn about users' journeys.
And for those that are not familiar with product design, how would you describe it to someone that might be less familiar with the tech space?
Okay. So when it comes to product design, I'll take a step back and talk about what user experience is about. So a user experience is like how people think and interact with, in this case, design digital spaces. So how you interact with an app, how do you navigate through the screens in order to get your task done, to get from point A to point B? And how does that reflect on your psyche? How does reflect on your behaviors, your patterns, things like that? And then with user experience, you're focusing mostly on the user themselves, so someone who is interacting with it. But then when it comes to product design, you're thinking more about not only about the user and how they interact with the service, but also where is the business impact and how does that reflect on all the work that you're doing as well. So there's like an added layer on top of UX. And it's really validating as a product designer to see how big the impact of your work and how far it can go. Because not only am I designing this experience for, say, a couple million people, but then it's just like, okay, at the end of the day, this can be correlated to this amount of revenue or these different key metrics that we're tracking and how people respond to our like contact list and like, oh, I don't like this experience. When people, when members write in and like, I wish you could fix this. Like, okay, we're listening and so forth and so forth. So product design is basically a UX designer with business a little bit more. And then it's...
Which one do you like more? UX versus product design?
I think I like product design the more that I go into it. There are so many aspects of product design. I've been leaning more into the growth aspect of how products and services can be elevated beyond their current state. And this is the spaces that really stand out most to people. I think when people think about like industry disruptors, the likes of like Airbnb in terms of like the hospitality space, Uber when it comes to taxi space, how could we take what exists today and make it better or elevate it into experience that people don't really think of? I think that's really exciting because it also adds an element of being able to dictate the future in a way too, with AI and machine learning being such huge buzzwords and huge, and a lot of companies are putting resources into developing that. Like, where can this go? And it's those people who are dictating those next couple of years of what AI could look like.
It makes me think of the song, The Room Where It Happens.
I don't think I've heard that song.
Hamilton? No.
I sadly have not seen that play yet. I know. I fail.
You do not fail. You just haven't experienced like the greatest musical of all time, hip hop musical, about the founding fathers. And there's a song that is entitled "The Room Where It Happens," and they talk about how in Washington D.C. they want to be in that room where it happens, where the backroom deals happen, which is hyper, D.C. in politics, but. In this software context, right, you're in the room where those choices are being created and those decisions are being arrived at for what you're going to go ship to those millions of customers. And so you were in the room where it happened.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. It's interesting to put it in that perspective.
And less like evil and greasy.
Yeah.
it's more like, how do we help our customers? Okay, so I want to talk to you about within the tech space, some companies are better than others, but you found yourself in a very, very predominantly white tech startup, yet you came from a historically black college. And so that can feel, I'm sure, maybe like night and day. Talk to me about your experience shifting from a college, again, that was really celebrating black culture, black history, and then finding yourself in a predominantly white space.
It's interesting that my experience at Howard pretty much set me up to understand that the industry is like. So they make sure that you're prepared in a way that people aren't going to look like you and that you will likely have to work so much harder in order to get into spaces that you belong in. And with that transition, I guess I was a little bit naive to think like, oh, I have like all these black friends in like engineering, like most of the people are either Asian or black or just different types of people. And then when I get into the industry, it's the opposite. And it was kind of like, oh, they did talk about this, but I didn't think it was like this or it was this bad. And so there was a little bit of preparation with that transition, but it gets more apparent as I transition further in my career. I think the more senior I become, the more that I realize how lonely it gets. And it's tragic that it is that way, but it is the reality. And when I join organizations and the first thing that I do is kind of like do a mental evaluation of who is like perceived as a person of color, like what are the demographics, whether it's who, like what types of ethnicities are represented, what types of genders are represented, what types of orientations are represented. And that kind of gives me an idea of how things could possibly go, whether it could be in my favor in a sense of, will my voice and my experiences be valued or will it be kind of like hushed and put in a corner? And I think having to do that mental work is tiring at times because it brings a lot of unnecessary anxiety when it comes to, it's like starting a new company or joining a company where they say that they appreciate authenticity or that they say like, oh, bring your whole authentic self to work every day. But then it's just like, is it like, it's authentic with an asterisk. And it goes with so many different companies, even in Silicon Valley with main companies, like there have been so many times where they've been called out for their diversity or lack of diversity, or even how they treat different types of employees based on what they perceive is acceptable for their company, while also tooting their own horn of saying, oh, we embrace everyone, but that is not true. So it's a very interesting experience as I continue my career, but I also try not to let it weigh me down or hold me back, but it is something that's almost always on my mind, which is, it's always interesting to navigate.
I'm curious, what would you, so like someone gave some sort of warning to you in school. You're like, okay, yep, noted. Like you just kind of, you filed it away. What would you tell yourself on graduation day from Howard, knowing what you know now? You're a couple of years, you're several years into your career. Mm-hmm. What would you tell yourself on graduation day about the world that Bisol is about to experience?
You will be okay.
Unpack that.
I think I held a lot of shame. Well, I knew I held a lot of shame when I graduated college because all my friends that had graduated with the same major as I did had sort of a next step. So some had either a job lined up or were going to like graduation or like sorry, graduate school. So they had like a next step. And then there's me and I've been applying to every single place under the sun and I would get no callbacks, no offers, nothing. So for a couple months after graduation, I was just at home applying and just internalizing a lot of that shame and guilt and not understanding what was wrong with my application or what I was doing wrong until I got the job offer that made me come to Arizona. And so knowing that things will be okay will be so comforting to younger me because I held on to so much, not knowing what lied ahead in the future.
Was there ever a time in your career where you experienced maybe a setback in your career because of the way your neurodivergent mind works?
Yes. There's a couple examples that bring up, but one that definitely shines the most is I need structure. I need, in order to fully understand something, I need kind of like the dossier on why does this exist? How are we doing this? What are the expectations? Like I need clear, concrete structure, directions. And there's been situations where I would express that I need that, but I couldn't get it, or it would just be mulled over as I get it, but it's the way it is. So you're just gonna have to deal. And trying to navigate those waters without getting those tools that I need to set me up for success has definitely made me suffer in some areas. And then I think also additionally, people talk about like playing the politics game with companies like rubbing elbows and you gotta play into like the whole boys girls clubs and things like that. Like I can't pretend. I don't know how to play the game, play the politics. I feel like at times that has hurt me in the past because I'm very much like a diligent worker bee. Like once you give me a task, I will complete it to the end. I will do what I need to do, make sure I dot my I's, cross my T's, and then give me the next task. But when it comes to not getting structure and then also having to play the politics game, I'm just lost/forgotten because I'm just doing what I need to do in this tiny little corner. So it's definitely have hurt me in the past when it comes to navigating like professional life and workspaces, especially when it comes to just being neurodivergent. And I'm still trying to figure out how to unpack that really, or what tools I could take on to navigate those waters. So,
well, to unpack your neurodivergence, I'm curious, is there a flavor of that neurodiversity that does exist that you're like, I think I'm with this people group? Like within the pool of neurodivergence, what What part of the pool do you identify with most?
Do you think I am on the autism spectrum, as well as I do suffer from anxiety and depression? But I think mostly identifying with autism really strikes a chord with me, because thinking about my childhood, there were just so many moments where I would either have problems with like eye contact. I would have to practice with eye contact, or I would mimic people's behavior or just gestures. There was like a period of time where I would just eat Kix every morning, every single day, like clockwork. And I couldn't diverge from it, because it just ruined the whole day. Or situations where till this day, I suffer with trash on the floor, like just trash when I'm outside the house, and I cannot deal with trash on the floor. Like, I mentally shut down, and it feels like my skin is crawling, things are crawling on my skin, and yeah. And I'm like, that's not normal, but I'll just keep it in and not really say much about it. So there's like little things that have come up over the years that I'm just like, this leans towards the autism spectrum.
I'm curious, with regards to the trash on the floor, is it hard for you to pick it up? Or like, so do you have like a super meticulous apartment? Or is it like, ooh, this is messy because the trash can be overwhelming? Which way do you go?
It's very specific. So the first time I realized it was an issue for me is being in other people's cars with trash on the floor.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So if there's trash on the floor and I can't like pick it up, or I guess it'd be like rude to pick it up and be like, oh, here's your trash on the floor. Do you want me to put in a bag for you in the back seat?
You heathen.
Without passing any type of judgment, I would just, what helps is I love being barefoot. So I would like slide a piece of my foot out of my shoe, and then I'll calm me down. It doesn't make sense.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm. It just provides some sort of comfort. And I think the worst time that I experienced it was on a road trip to San Antonio from Arizona. We stopped at a Texas Roadhouse. It was me, my fiance, his mom, his brother, and his stepdad, and they're excited to go to Texas Roadhouse. I don't eat red meat or pork, so I was just like, I hope there's options for meat. And then it's the end of the night. We walk in. It's just very crowded, noisy. There's just trash, so much trash under the table. I could not concentrate on eating. I was just so uncomfortable. I just wanted to leave. Like, I disassociated, went to my happy place, and then came back anytime someone tried to refer to me in the conversation. But it was severely painful.
I want to loop back to like when you said you went to your happy place in like the 200 and 300 level engineering classes. You said you wrote fanfic. What kind of fanfic what are you a fan that you write fiction for?
So back then it was a lot of just like random K-pop.
Sure.
Fiction. And I also realized that I go through intense obsession phases as well. So that college was my intense K-pop, just drama obsession. Before that, it was just Bollywood and Indian entertainment. And then so much so that I wrote my senior paper on the motifs and themes of love and marriage of Bollywood from the decades of 1970s all the way to 1990s. And I watched like 100, like 60 to 100 films. for that. It was a lot. And I think now it's in the realm of, let's say, more book fandom. So Harry Potter is a huge one. Lately, I've been getting into the Pyrian fandom, which is the Fourth Wing, Iron Flame, Rebecca Yarros fantasy novels. And I'm a huge Potter fan. And I'm slowly getting into being a Disney adult as well.
So
there's just a lot of intense loves, which make no sense, but it makes sense to me.
One last question I have for you on the career front is, what advice would you offer to hiring managers or just, you know, people managers wanting to support and come alongside their neurodivergent employees?
Care. I've encountered, especially as a software engineer, software developer, going through whiteboarding parts of interviews and just doing coding challenges, and you can sense that that the interviewer would rather be anywhere but in that room with you, and really they don't care about understanding who you are as a person. And the biggest things that they say in those interviews is like, tell me how you think, talk out loud. And I'm telling you how I think, but if the way that I think doesn't align with what your standards of what thinking should be, then is it a problem with me, or is it a problem with the institution or the standards that they have for hiring? And so I wish that they cared a little bit more about really understanding their applicants, really understanding their journey and the way that they think. Because I believe that people who have varying ways of processing information or processing just thinking in general, and having just that general diversity could bring so much value into companies in ways that they don't really understand. I would say, please care. Please.
Well, we've seen companies have DEI teams, DEI departments, or initiatives, and they promote it and they talk about it very publicly. What would great look like from your vantage point, beyond like leveraging it as a marketing mechanism? What would a great DEI program look like in practice as an employee?
I believe a great DEI practice should be elements of top-down approach, but then also bottom-up.
Okay.
In my experience, usually DEI initiatives come from the employees realizing that there's a need, or at least a gap that exists within the company. And leadership from the top don't really see it as a problem because they're really removed from the everyday life that the employees experience. So I'd really appreciate if leaders could also bring the emphasis of investing in DEI initiatives, really taking it upon themselves to really reflect on how they interact with their employees, and not only have it as like an employee driven thing, but also have it as like a leadership employee collaboration of sorts. And then rather having it as a marketing ploy, which always annoys me so much, I wish it was a more of a, not only do we say and do this, but this is how it really impacts our company culture, how our employees experience their day to day, because that's usually when employees are really experiencing or really showing their authentic self. And if they can really work through, do their 9-to-5, doing what tasks they need to do, and not have to hide or shield part of themselves from the organization, I think they'll be able to flourish. I think they will be able to really bring their A game and not have to worry about any other thing because the company says that they care without really caring. And so I ultimately think when it comes to DEI initiatives, yeah, it should be, everybody should be on the same page. And when DEI surveys go out and they gather this information, there needs to be actionable items and really act upon it versus being like, oh, we get this data just to see how it looks. We're just keeping it for records. I mean, that's cool, but like, now what? We're not just doing it for the sake of doing it. We need to depart.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's similar to customer research, and something I've talked to a researcher that I know quite well is that if the information does not lead to transformation, we just wasted our time. Like we did a thing for the sake of doing a thing. Mm-hmm. And I find that customer research, which the parallel is, right, if you're going to do the survey or spend the time, it should hopefully lead to some sort of transformation of like, okay, we thought this, but now we're going to do this because we had a paradigm shift of what it means to be truly accessible, to be an ally of all individuals, not just, you know, socioeconomic or racial. Mm-hmm. It could be intellectual diversity as well. And so I think it goes back to that idea of information hopefully leading to transformation. And some companies do it. Not all companies stick the landing, but I was curious to hear your vantage point of what great might look like in that ideal situation.
Yeah, and I think that's also the reason why I love accessibility so much. And I think when I joined our previous company, that was one thing that I was like, we don't have anything on accessibility. Immediately types up this whole document and send it to you. Be like, this is why we need this. And so I think, yeah, just being able to be an advocate for all people and really have a space for everyone to come to the table, I think is really important.
When we met earlier, you had highlighted the value of advocating for yourself. Tell me your story and how you came to that realization.
I think there's elements of advocating for myself in a medical space and a professional space. Usually in medical spaces, there's been times where I would bring up a concern that I'm experiencing and doctors or providers would more so just write it off as like a minimal thing or like, oh, you'll be fine. I remember a couple of years ago, I was experiencing chronic nausea and I really did not understand why I was experiencing it or where it was coming from. And it was something that I experienced from, I would say, like sophomore year of high school all the way until, say, like a few years ago. And when I moved to Arizona, I immediately thought I should go see a specialist. I should really figure things out. Went to a specialist and they're like, this is not funny, but they were like, oh, we'll take you through this whole procedure. You'll be knocked out. We'll take a biopsy on your stomach, things like that. And then they do that and they're like, nothing's wrong. Here's some nausea pills. High five. And that was pretty much it. No follow-up, no other resources that could help me.
Wow.
The nausea pills didn't even help. I pretty much just took one and threw it away. I leaned more into natural remedies like ginger tablets, ginger tea. That helped. But then I continued to go and seek out other doctors. And that led me to my current doctor today, which he really sat me down, really listened to all of my symptoms, really listened to even other symptoms that had, in my mind, no correlation to my chronic nausea, but it could have an element into exacerbating this symptom that I've been experiencing. And through that process of really not taking that previous doctor's insight and advocating for myself really helped tremendously into getting to the space where I am today, which is not experiencing nausea and being able to adjust other levels of my health. And now I'm in a healthier space. And I think additionally with professional life and advocating for myself, that has definitely been a struggle. But it presents itself when negotiating pay or really being able to say that I have done ABCD, I've worked hard on all these projects, these are the metrics that show and reflect all the efforts that I put in, and this is what I should be compensated with, this is how I maybe should be promoted. In those situations, I have always been hesitant in the past to bring those up because there'd be an element of, oh, I don't want to rub anyone the wrong way, or I don't want to seem ungrateful, or I don't want to just like put a bad taste in someone's mouth. And I think it's an element of being not only a woman, but a Black woman, and just essentially being told like, take whatever you get and be happy with it. And being able to advocate myself like going forward in my career has definitely helped me tremendously, being able to have all my accomplishments ready to go without even putting emotion into it, because it's very factual and logical. Being able to negotiate pay or other resources with my compensation that allows me to do my job in a better capacity than I had before. And so being able to advocate for myself in those two areas have resulted in a better life, I guess, just like a better life environment and being able to live in a way that I really like to live.
Okay, we're going to shift into our lightning round. Are you ready?
Maybe. Yes.
Okay, what is the last great book that you've read?
Ooh, A Good Girl's Guide to Murder. I think that's the title. Yeah.
Damn, what a title. Next up, what's a song or playlist or an artist that you keep on repeat right now?
Right now, I've been looping through a playlist of the soundtrack for One Day on Netflix. Great series. Teared, cried. But it's just like a lot of instrumental, invokes a lot of emotion. I love it.
Okay. I was on the fence because I like saw the trailer and I was like, I don't know. It looked like it was like going to go a really negative direction. I was like, I don't know if I want to know this. So I will have to give that a watch after. I just finished Beef last night, Ali Wong's Beef, and 10 out of 10 recommend. Slow the burn. Okay, next up, advice that you would give to your younger self.
It kind of goes back to like a previous advice that I gave to myself, I think like after graduating, like you will be okay. I think I want to emphasize on that because I do remember growing up, even still to this day, really worrying about the future and how it'll develop, and a lot of emphasis on making the right decision and making sure that I'll like be the best person, do the right thing. There's like this perfectionism that comes with a lot that I do, and so taking that intensity away and just knowing that who I am as a person is okay and I will be okay is very comforting.
When you're flooded or overwhelmed, what techniques do you employ to self-regulate?
Usually it's a combination of like the shoe technique, sliding out one of my feet from a shoe, counting down while taking deep breaths usually help. A technique that one of my therapists taught me is just going to your happy place, which is like a space that you have identified as just a place that is calming and safe. And mine is basically walking on a beach just like chilling on a beach with my fiance and just being in nature, which is very calming for me. So I'd say the two that I tend to go to quite often is the counting and the happy space.
What's your favorite neurodivergent purchase?
Oh, Loop. These Loop ear things. If you just put in your ear and it like funnels out all the additional noise, it's wonderful. And especially wonderful during like concerts and stuff. But there's a lot of like sensory overload, especially like auditory stuff. Wonderful. Loop.
I'm curious, what model of Loop do you have? There's like five, and I have analysis paralysis, and so I haven't bought them yet. I am hoping that one day they sponsor this podcast, Loop, if you're listening.
Whatever these are, I don't know. They're just okay. Regular black ones.
Okay. Good to know. I think you're like the third or the fourth person that has said that for their favorite neurodivergent purchase. So there's definitely a trend there. Next up, what's the best advice that you've received from someone else?
One that comes to mind is, it's your life, live it well. And that's a piece of advice that one of my sisters gave me when I moved to Arizona by myself. And it was one of those situations where me as a person questions a lot of what I do, how I could navigate life, and what is the right/perfect way of doing things. And so being cognizant of others' expectations and worrying about disappointing people and things like that, really taking the power back of understanding that this is my life and my decisions are the best for myself. And all I can do is just live my life and live it well. And I think it's very comforting.
Okay. New question that has come about. You are the first person to answer this new question. And my hope is to have guests ask the audience a question themselves. And so Spotify has a little question feature. YouTube has its comment section. What is a question that you might offer as a reflection prompt an answer you want to hear from the audience? Maybe you have a poll that you would like to ask this neurodivergent group and hear their answers. What might your question for either reflection or, again, gathering insights from other badasses like yourself?
I think a prompt. Just kind of open-ended. Sure. Breath. Mm-hmm. I shine the brightest when I ...
Okay. Great for reflection. I will say selfishly, I want to hear the answers. And last and final question, any parting words or advice for the audience that's listening to this, hearing your story today?
I would say continue being yourself. Trust your gut and always advocate for yourself, whether or not you feel like someone's listening or not listening to you. But at the end of the day, you got yourself. And the more that you advocate for yourself, somebody is going to be willing to listen and then advocate with you.
I love that. If this episode was helpful or encouraging, consider sharing it with a friend. That's the best way to support this podcast. And if you listening to this, or if you have a loved one that you think would be a great guest, I would love to hear from them. I would love to connect with them and get to know their story. So there's going to be a link in the show notes below. Please don't hesitate to reach out, right? You don't have to be Elon Musk or anyone crazy impressive. We just want to hear your stories so that other people around the world, there's thousands of people that listen to this, can maybe see some of their story in your story. So I would love to hear from you. And with that, we'll talk to you next week.